Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, a senior editor at The New Yorker. Kanye, Elon, Trump. This is not the first line of the world's worst haiku, but rather something that the House GOP account tweeted a few weeks ago. Since then, Kanye West has cemented his role as a poster child of the Republican Party with a series of bizarre political stunts. First, he appeared at Paris Fashion Week, wearing a t-shirt that read, "White Lives Matter." Then, he started making incendiary comments on social media and in interviews. On one podcast, West alleged that George Floyd died of a fentanyl overdose, a claim that prompted the Floyd family to announce a $250 million lawsuit against him. On Tucker Carlson Tonight, West made anti-Semitic comments, some of which were so explicit that they were cut from the interview before it aired. West, who now goes by the name Ye, has declared his intention to buy a social network called Parler, a conservative alternative to Twitter. In an official statement, Parler said that West's support would help the platform, quote, create a truly non-cancelable environment. My colleague Andrew Marantz, who has reported extensively on the far right for The New Yorker, joins me today to discuss the free speech debate and the political evolution of a hip-hop icon. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So, my first question for you is, what is the best Kanye West song and why is it Runaway?
I'm not in a very runaway place right now. I've been in a more like an ultralight beam place. But this is what makes it all so sad is I feel like for people who are a little too young or a little too old, it doesn't quite land just the importance of who Kanye West was and is. I think for people who know him as famous rapper, famous producer, it's kind of just another celebrity scandal. But I feel like for people who are whatever range of generations we are, it means a lot more than that. I mean, I've tried to explain it to people in my parents' generation as, I don't know, like, what if you found out that John Lennon was actually in some Nazi gang in his youth in England? It wouldn't just be, oh, a celebrity scandal. It would be a personal betrayal.
Yeah.
That's kind of what Kanye means to people. It's not just the music that was on the radio. It's like music that was on the radio and aspired to be in the pantheon of eternal greatness and succeeded. And now it's marred by all of this. Yeah, it's sad.
It's hard to be a Kanye West fan. But it's also always been kind of hard to be a Kanye West fan.
I know.
I'm wondering how much of, what he's been saying and doing recently, I guess, like, how much of a departure that feels from what he was doing earlier in his career.
Yeah, he's always put his fans through a lot. He's always had a nose for provocation and controversy. And it's funny, in this recent cycle of him saying unforgivable stuff, people will often say, whatever happened to the Kanye of, you know, Katrina, George Bush doesn't care about black people? Like, that Kanye was speaking truth to power. But it's not like this streak wasn't there all along. I mean, you can see it throughout his career. He's not made a secret of the idea that he wants to, as he put it, smash his boat into the Truman Show painting.
Yeah.
Like, he just wants to ram his head through the fourth wall all the time.
I mean, you've been covering the far right for many years, and you've obviously talked to a lot of people who have gone through the process of political radicalization. And so I'm wondering, like, if you could talk a little bit about the old Kanye for our listeners who don't know every single detail of his career the way that we do. And then also, like, I guess I'm wondering if you think that what we've seen of him in terms of his, like, political transformation, if it kind of mirrors what you've seen from other figures on the right, or if he's sort of singular in that way.
Yeah. He's unfortunately really not singular at this point as a propagandist, or I would argue as a musician, which is really the sad thing. Like,
This
is not even Kanye being interesting.
Yeah.
Like, as you say, as somebody who has covered various people's radicalizations over the years, I basically could recite every step of where the Ye radicalization story was going to go next. I feel like he's so formulaic, even in his radicalization. So, like, by the time he got to just pure, unfiltered anti-Semitism, I was like, really? We've ended in this place? Because, I mean, just to take it back a step, when I started swimming through the cesspools of the internet as a reporter, I was really surprised at how often we ended up talking about, like, Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Mein Kampf. I was like, really, guys? Like, you haven't updated your bad ideas? You haven't come up with new bad ideas? It's just the same old. So when I saw Kanye just, like, being like, you know what the problem is? The Jews. I was like, okay, man, I've watched so many people go down this road, and like, it is an interesting, enduring mystery to me why we always tend to end up there.
Yeah.
But like, he's just doing the thing that every lonely, sad teenager does when they spend too much time on the internet.
And how much of this do you think should be read as like performance art, or at least as part of, you know, the image of Ye and whatnot? Like, I feel like I'm constantly struggling with the question of whether he's just being like a provocateur and whether this is all part of the act, or whether this is like an actual political message that he wants me to absorb.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you encounter this with someone like Alex Jones or with Donald Trump to some extent. Like, when does the facade break? When does the character end? With someone like Ye, it's like, who knows? I don't think it's clear to him. He's lived in public for so long, and he's had these really grand slash grandiose visions of himself for so long. And like, I think it's a little bit of that kind of stand-up comedian dynamic where you try something in front of the crowd and you see how they react. And he has a little bit of that toddler thing of like, any attention is good attention. In terms of the political stances, like, he will often say, I don't know, I just feel this way. You know, his whole slavery is a choice thing. He was kind of just trying stuff out, and it didn't go that well. You know, he had like watched a couple of YouTube videos and he was trying to regurgitate them. Often it's very clear you can track the source of it to like one thing. You know, all of his George Floyd slander, he basically watched one Candace Owens thing and then was like just repeating stuff from that sort of propaganda video.
Yeah.
So he's not exactly the most like skeptical imbiber of information all the time. But with the Jewish stuff, like, you know, it's interesting because somehow in the last few weeks he decided that the Jewish business cabal is like holding him back. And I don't know exactly what the inciting incident for that was. And then people told him, you're not supposed to say that. And then that, for a personality like his, was like, okay, I'm going to say it more. And then he did this Tucker Carlson interview where, from what I can tell, I watched the whole thing, at least the parts that they aired, and I didn't see Tucker asking him a single tough question about any of this. I mean, forget even the anti-Semitism. Like, not even like, hey, what are you talking about in this particular moment? Can you explain what you mean? Like, I didn't see him saying anything like that.
What were the questions like? Was it just kind of like, how do you feel about having been censored? Or?
Yeah. The questions were like, how come you're so stifled all the time? And like, what would you like to say about that?
And I wish someone would ask me that.
I know. Yeah. And then he would talk for 5 minutes and Tucker would be like, yeah. And that was kind of it. And like, sure, there's a place for interviews where you're just giving someone the microphone, but I don't think this was the right one. And then he went on Drink Champs, this like very loose, free-form podcast with people who are his friends. They're from the hip-hop community. He called it like returning to the culture, like this was supposed to be a kind of homecoming. But the Drink Champs guys were like, you know, yay, I think you just were hurt by like a few people in the business world and they all happen to be Jewish. And that's how you developed this whole theory that the Jews are out to get you. And he was like, yeah, maybe you're right. And he kind of had this like epiphany moment live on air where he was like, yeah, maybe I've been going about this all wrong. I mean, it was kind of interesting. Like,
yeah.
And as a fan, as a viewer, and as somebody who thinks it's bad for the world when celebrities are out there making violent threats against Jews or anyone, I was very much smacking my forehead at that moment being like, could you not have thought this through for 30 seconds before you did all this publicly? But I just don't think that's how Kanye's used to operating. He said, I use social media as my therapy. He just like says what he feels and then he waits for the pushback. Like, I don't think it makes sense to someone like him to hash these things out privately. Whenever someone texts him, he posts their texts on Instagram. Like, I don't think he lives life in private mode kind of ever.
Yeah, I mean, he's been pretty open, too, about his, you know, his struggle with mental health issues. He's bipolar. I mean, I guess how much do you think we should take that into account when weighing some of these more outlandish political statements?
Yeah. I mean, it has to be part of it. He has said that he has this diagnosis. He has then said he thinks it's a misdiagnosis. Sometimes he's on his meds. Sometimes he's off his meds. There's a whole discourse about, you know, let's hold Kanye accountable for the things he says and not just excuse it or write it all off to mental illness. And I get that, but it's clearly a factor. We could just sort of sit here in a sober-minded way and say, like, what are the political arguments for and against Kanye's anti-Semitism? But, like, clearly there's a personal crisis going on here. I think it would be irresponsible to ignore that.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's, like, almost inappropriate of Tucker Carlson to kind of, like, exploit someone in this kind of position and try to turn it into a, you know, a political message, basically?
Yeah. I think it's pretty gross. I mean, he's clearly having a crisis. And to just do this disingenuous thing of like, why don't we listen to the man and listen to his explanations? It's like, I don't think that's the most responsible way to go about it, to just hand someone the microphone when clearly they are using the microphone to harm their own legacy and like the feelings of millions of people.
Yeah. Was there anything interesting that came out of that interview? Like, I guess it sounds like Tucker didn't really push him on anything, but like, did he say anything that felt like especially revealing or, you know, that sort of like helped you figure out how to even approach this whole saga?
I mean, I, as a West completist, if there's new content, I will absorb it. So I'm always interested, and I was very interested in the parts that Vice reported on that were left on the cutting room floor, which were sort of scary and were actually indicative of like a very fragile frame of mind. Like, he was talking about imposter children being placed in his home and like stuff that seemed really like, again, to your point, if Tucker Carlson were being a responsible person, he would probably be like, I think we should cancel this interview.
Yeah, because that those things call into question everything else that he has just
said. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just to be clear, like, I think the headline that a lot of people might have heard is Kanye West tweeted, I want to go DEFCON 3 on the Jewish people. That is what he tweeted. Now, it's weird out of context. It's weird in context. I don't really know what it's supposed to mean. I don't think that he is literally threatening to do literal violence to Jewish people. As a Jewish person, I did not feel physically threatened by that tweet.
I took DEFCON 3 as like epic rant coming. You
yes,
know?
Right. And it was also just funny because the whole tweet was like, I'm really sleepy right now, but when I wake up, I'm going to go DEFCON 3 on the Jews. Like, okay. And then also in the same tweet, he was like, also, just so you know, I can't be anti-Semitic because I am Jew. I was like, okay, so somebody has been talking to Kanye about some theories about how black people are the actual Jews, and he's gone on subsequently to unpack this. Like, this is where I sort of have the pathos response and the anger response. Like, I'm angry at him, but I'm also just, like, feel literal pity towards him. And even as a Jew talking about anti-Semitism, it's still a little bit difficult to talk about because everybody experiences it differently. But what my experience of it is like, it's just generally a bad sign when anyone who's that prominent in American culture gets to a place of talking about let's do something bad to the Jews. Like, it's a very canary in the coal mine moment.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think Kanye is like a committed ideological anti-Semite in the way that a lot of the people I've interviewed, like literal Nazis I've interviewed, are. But it's definitely not a good sign. And it definitely makes you wish that somebody who he trusted could get to him at a moment where he was feeling calm and just be like, you know what? You're not wrong that there are a lot of Jews in the media. That's a fact that you've observed. And that's a true thing. There are historical, sociological, anthropological reasons for that. What it's not is it's not a nefarious cabal that's like out to get you. Like, I wonder if there's anyone in his ear who's trying to explain to him these individual dots you're trying to connect, you're not doing a good job of connecting them.
Yeah, and I mean, you raise an interesting point, which is also that Ye tweets this thing, his Twitter account is then immediately frozen, which then, you know, probably leads to, you know, even more conspiratorial thinking, because it's like, my Twitter account's gone. Seems like someone has power and it's not me.
Yeah, you must have touched a nerve. Yeah. And I will tell you, you know, I've watched a lot of the YouTube videos about people responding to this and commentary on this, and a really scary number of the YouTube comments are like, hey, like if they want to shut you down, like it shows you who's really in power, like again and again and again and again. So like, I don't take an absolutist approach to any of this stuff. I don't think it's coherent to say everything on social media should stay up. I don't think it's appropriate to say everything I don't like should come down. But I will say that, like, it is pretty unnerving to me how you can't fully put these things back in the box. Even when you try to take them down, there's always someone somewhere else who's like, I'm going to echo that. The fact that you took it down makes me even more convicted in my feeling that someone needs to say it.
So after Kanye West realized that he can't just say absolutely anything he wants on Twitter, he decided to buy Parler, which is an alternative to Twitter. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us, like, sort of what Parler is. I mean, I think the main thing that people know about it is that it was one of the platforms where plans for January 6th, you know, were discussed. But what I can't tell is whether it's, like, a social media platform for conservatives or whether it's an alternative social media platform that conservatives have, like, co-opted. Maybe those are, like, the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a few things. One is I feel bad for conservatives because a few times in this conversation we've sort of said, like, the conservative Kanye West who thinks we should go DEFCON 3 on the Jews and who thinks, you know, whatever. And I'm like, that's actually not a conservative position. It's not my problem, but, like, I think somebody in the conservative movement should probably sort out, like, how to delineate those things because it's bad branding for everyone.
I mean, I feel like Kanye going on Tucker was, like, the official sort of, like, you are one of us now.
Totally. Well, and also, you know, he wore the Trump hat and he was sort of in that orbit. But he now refers to himself as a pro-life conservative in a way that he didn't. And, I mean, the House GOP account tweeted, Elon, Trump, Kanye. That was the tweet. And it's like, okay, cool. Like, that's your Mount Rushmore, I guess. But, like, really? That's the House GOP position? I get that you want to harness any amount of cool-based cultural energy that is, like, on your side of the culture war. Like, obviously, yeah, like, there's energy out there. You might as well exploit it. But come on, guys. This is not the best that the Party of Lincoln can do. But again, not my problem. In terms of what Parler is and, like, basically at a very high level, if you want to run a social network, you always want to be chasing this, like, asymptotic ideal of pure free speech. So every new social network that has ever been invented has started from the premise that we're going to be the place that once and for all actually protects free speech, right? Because free speech is like puppies and babies and rainbows. Like, nobody's against free speech. Mm-hmm. And as long as you're not forced to define or constrain what that means as a business, you just, like, use it as branding. This was Reddit. This was Twitter. Twitter executives were famously going around calling themselves the free speech wing of the free speech party back in the day. And then Twitter becomes the big bad monolith.
Now they're like, all the news that's fit to print.
Right. Exactly. Like, because nobody wants to be the gatekeeper. But, like, it just is the case that if you are the host of a conversation and you decide to abdicate your hosting duties and let people do whatever they want, people are going to do some wild, bad stuff, and then you're faced with a choice. Is this bad stuff that we want to allow or bad stuff we don't want to allow? So if you're Facebook, you don't allow pornography. If you're Twitter, you do. That's a business decision. That's not a First Amendment decision. That's a business decision. Same thing for hate speech. Same thing for doxing. So, like, these guys that, you know, Elon and Kanye and Tucker Carlson and all these guys, they're always saying, I love free speech. They'll even sometimes call themselves a free speech absolutist. If you run a social media company and people want to dox people and put their home addresses online, do you keep that up or take that down? Well, no, I'm against doxing because then, you know, that could be bad, that could be violent. Okay, so you're not a free speech absolutist. That's not a thing that is inscribed by law. That's not a rule that the government is telling you you have to follow. That's a policy that as a business you want to enforce. So it's just a pose, and it's, like, frankly, a very flimsy pose.
So what's the point of Ye buying Parler if Musk is turning Twitter into something similar?
Well, I think part of it is that he just wants to be cool like his big bro, Elon. I mean, I think part of it is hero
worship.
Do they
have a relationship?
Oh, yeah. From the way they talk about it, I think they think they're both, like, you know, part of the Avengers of, like, design and innovation and visionary thought. I think that they think that there are, like, 5 Walt Disney, Steve Jobs, Leonardo da Vinci level people in the world, and they are part of that crew.
Yeah.
So clearly a lot of the recent outbursts that Ye has had have been around him not feeling like he has the assets to match his talents. So I think he is just like, well, I'm a generational talent, so I should own generational wealth. So part of it is just that. He wants to have multiple businesses. But I think also, you know, I quoted in this piece I just wrote the famous A.J. Liebling line of I forget exactly how he says it, freedom of the press is only guaranteed to those who own one. And so I think at some point, if you're Elon or Kanye or I guess Trump, but Trump is really not good at actually owning businesses. But I think if you're one of those people, it's like, well, if everybody really decides to cancel me, like I just am going to own the means of production when it comes to speech.
We'll have more with Andrew Marantz in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Do you think it's a big deal that Kanye is buying Parler? I feel like it definitely represents something,
yeah.
But do you think that the platform is going to become way more popular or ever have a chance really of competing with something like Twitter, or is it really just like a virtue signal?
Right. It's a signal of some kind. I don't know if it's a good business decision, and I also don't know if the deal will go through. I mean, obviously there's been months of drama about whether the Elon Twitter deal will go through, and it's still unresolved. So it's totally possible that they just put out this press release because Parler is a company that's run by Candace Owens' husband and they're all friends, and they just said, well, let's make this announcement, and then whether the deal actually closes or not, you know, we at least get some publicity out of it. That's possible. It's also possible that he does buy it and, you know, I don't know. I mean, he had his thing with The Gap. He had his thing with Adidas. Like, a lot of his business things blow up. So it might blow up. But with something like Parler, you know, so as you said, part of what people know about Parler, if they know anything, is that it was a place where people were planning the January 6th attack. That's kind of a good example of what I mean about how there are no easy answers when it comes to content moderation, because I think we all have pretty similar intuitions when it comes to, you know, should people be allowed to go on a social network and say they don't like Joe Biden, obviously. Should people be allowed to say, I think Trump should stay in the White House? Sure. Should they be able to say, I'm going to coordinate to go to the Capitol with guns? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
How many steps can you push it until, okay, we're just going to have to stop you from, like, nobody is comfortable with the idea that somebody somewhere is going to tell you you can't type words onto a computer screen. Like, it feels very bad. It feels Orwellian. I think we are right to be extremely skeptical of anyone who wants to censor anything for any reason. Like,
yeah, I'm like, who are these moderators?
I know.
Like,
I know. It's the right response.
And like, who actually are they? I mean, what are the, I guess, requirements to be a moderator on Twitter? Is it like 4-year undergraduate degree? Do you know what the average profile of like a Twitter moderator is?
Yeah, they all have to be philosophy professors. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, actually, so a lot of these companies will outsource it, literally. So Facebook is the one I've spent the most time reporting on. All their content moderation is farmed out to outsourcing companies, mostly in Dublin, Berlin. I think they had a couple of shops in Arizona and Texas. Those have been shut down now. So there's no consistent profile for the experience that these people have to have. And the way they try to get around that is they try to say, okay, well, these people actually don't use that much discretion. They're operating from this system, this like book of rules.
They're like looking for slurs and like active harassment and just very, they don't have to make that many judgment calls.
Right. But what ends up happening is that it becomes this like Borgesian, like ever expanding text.
Yeah.
People are inventing new racist slurs every 5 seconds. And so it's, I guess, an understandable goal that you don't want people using their individual discretion too much because that feels arbitrary. But then it's like, so you're going to write down every possible way that someone could be bad on the internet before it happens? Like, that's not possible. So there's always going to be some room for discretion and dispute. What Facebook did is they built this Supreme Court of Facebook where they tried to let people appeal the decisions. But like, as you can imagine, I've had a million conversations about content moderation, and I always feel like they start too late because by the time we're talking about should this thing be taken down and can you appeal the takedown, it's way too late. I mean, it just reminds me of being like, okay, should we amputate this diabetic person's leg? It's like we should be talking about the food desert that happened 50 years ago to make the person, you know what I mean?
Totally. And
yeah, I mean, difficult decisions have to be made, but it's an ecosystem level problem. By the time you have someone like, whether famous or not, being radicalized to the point where they're saying stuff about the Jews, so many things have been so poisonous in the cesspool of our information ecosystem for so long that it's like almost, I don't want to say beside the point, but it's inadequate at that point to talk about do we take it down or leave it up.
Yeah, I mean, I've been wondering like what even is the, I guess, like the goal of a conservative social media platform? Like, you know, ideally, would it be a place for conservatives to like go and collude like in a safe space? You know, if they're concerned about like the Hunter Biden laptop story being censored from Twitter, it doesn't really help for it to be on Parler where everyone else, you know, already kind of knew about the story and agreed with it immediately.
Totally.
So like, yeah, if they're trying to disseminate information, it's really not helpful actually to have something like Parler. They're irrelevant from the get-go if they brand themselves as a conservative platform.
Totally. Like, you can have your little clubhouse or your safe space or wherever you feel comfortable, but ultimately the big time vision has to be, how are we going to be the next de facto public square? And maybe that those days are over, and maybe there won't be another de facto public square in the same way that there isn't a like one place to get your evening news the way there was in the 50s. Like, maybe there won't be another place like Facebook where if you want to see everyone's baby photos, you have to go there. But to the extent that that's going to exist, every social network, whether they admit it or not, is vying to have a shot at being that thing. And so, yeah, if you're the place where you're only welcome here if you're like plotting a violent militia revolution, like, you're not going to win market share. So it's a political problem, it's a civilizational problem, but it's also a business problem.
So the CEO of Parler is George Farmer, who is the husband of Candace Owens, who's someone who Kanye has been seen around with a lot recently. She wore the White Lives Matter shirt along with him at the fashion show, and she's been a big influence on him. Can you talk a little bit about Owens and Farmer and sort of like what you know about them?
Yeah. I mean, I went to CPAC Hungary a few months ago, and they were both there. Candace Owens was very visibly pregnant, and she had by far the most casual admirers kind of hanging around her. There was kind of a line to shake her hand. And also, I heard that Viktor Orban in Hungary was like very interested in meeting with Candace Owens specifically. So Candace Owens, I mean, I've been tracking her for a while. She used to be sort of on the left. People forget this, but her first thing was trying to like dox far right people on the internet. She's had a very weird career. Then she used to go on Alex Jones a lot. And then she kind of very slowly tried to defringify herself. And now she's pretty close to the center of the conservative movement. She has this talk show on The Daily Wire, and she's kind of seen as a relatively mainstream voice, which I think says more about the conservative movement than it says about Candace Owens specifically. She's very, very, very good, like Ye is, at feeling her way to where the energy is. She's like, let me get to the third rail as quickly as possible, and then it's not always clear what she's going to do once she gets there. But, you know, she's a black woman, and she's made a lot of her career out of being like anti-Black Lives Matter, anti-George Floyd. So the White Lives Matter shirt, for example, I don't know if it was her idea, but it seems like a very Candace Owens-y thing to do, to say, well, look, I'm just going to say this simple thing, and people are going to freak out, and then sort of play dumb a little bit when people freak, like, you know, why are you all so mad? I'm just saying this obvious thing. That's like trolling 101.
Yeah. This path that you've described for Owens, this like sort of like fringe to mainstream conservative pipeline, is that you? Could you see Kanye going down that path too, or do you think that he's always going to be sort of, you know, a different kind of figure?
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of gone back and forth between the fringe and the mainstream a few times. You know, I would like to hope that we are not going to live in a near future America where Let's DEFCON 3, the Jewish people, is a mainstreamized thing, but one never knows. I mean, I think that, like, there are a lot of things that one could draw as conclusions from the Trump years, many, many things, and some of them contradictory. But I think one of the things you can draw is that, like, you can contradict yourself, you can contain multitudes. If you're charismatic enough and you keep moving quickly enough and you throw enough smoke behind you, people will forgive a lot of stuff.
So something that's come up a lot on this show is the way in which the Republican Party has become almost totally beholden to the grievances of one man. And, you know, with Ye, I feel like his large and fragile ego, that's like a big part of his persona and his brand. And so I guess I'm wondering if you think that, you know, in a way he's sort of like the perfect fit for the conservative movement.
That big ego song actually gets slept on, but I think it's a really good one. He hasn't done that many things with Beyoncé. And I think that the fact that that was what they chose to collaborate on was like an extended phallic ego fragility metaphor is like very interesting in retrospect. Yeah, I mean, to the extent that all politics is a culture war and that all culture wars are nationalized, I mean, Kanye is an extremely useful asset in that regard. He doesn't have the ground game retail politics skill that a politician has, but he has a consistently demonstrated ability to capture the national attention, and that kind of turns out to be the most important skill in national politics, unfortunately. And I mean, it was interesting watching the Tucker interview because clearly the biggest overlap in the Venn diagram between Ye and Tucker is sort of using the idea of Trump as a culture war cudgel. If I had to guess, I don't think either of them really loves hanging out with Donald Trump as a person. I think they know how to use Trump as a signifier. And then when Kanye went on Drink Champs, he kind of sold out the Tucker interview a little bit and was like, they just wanted to use me to pander to the Trump base, but I'm bigger than that. So this is the problem they've had with Trump ever since June 2015. How much can you ride the tiger and how much does the tiger just run roughshod all over you?
Yeah.
How much can you use the energy within the base that Trump, you know, unleashed? And then how much can you convert that to your own ends? There will be a post-Trump generation, but they kind of in a way have to wait for Trump to get out of the way. And that's when you have all these people like DeSantis, like Kanye, like Tucker, like Tom Cotton, whoever, Ted Cruz, who have different instinctive approaches to how charismatically they can win over the base. And at that point, it's just going to be a kind of Darwinian struggle for attention.
That's probably a good place to end. But because I'm obsessed with Kanye, I feel like I need to ask you the real question, which is like, what does this all mean for his career?
I know.
I feel like, you know, over the years, I've actually been surprised by how willing people are to sort of like forgive his various comments. Like I thought that he was done after the slavery is a choice thing. And he seems to kind of be complaining about censorship and cancel culture. But like, do you think that this is actually the first time that he is getting canceled? Or do you think that if his goal is to get attention, he's definitely doing it? Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering where you see things going from here and if there is a line that he can cross or whether it's just, you know, sort of anything goes.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about his legacy. This has got to be in the first paragraph of your obituary now. Like, why are you making that choice? And it's just like, it's sad for the whole body of work. He was supposed to be the person who was just this unassailable genius, and now he's this assailable genius.
Yeah.
And it's just so sad because, like, we don't have that many geniuses. I'm not excusing it. I'm obviously not excusing it. I don't think it's cool to be anti-Semitic. But as an artist, I don't think this is that far from what one could expect. Artists are weird, vile, erratic people. Like, I think what's weird about it is that because everything has become national politics, you can't just be a weird, terrible asshole who's an artist. You have to be all those things and also running for president? Like, why? Why can't you just be an artist?
Andrew Marantz is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. You can read his daily comment, Kanye West Parlor Games, on NewYorker.com now. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Michelle Moses with support from Sydney Cobb. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening.